Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
I want to thank you for being so nice, man. I want to thank you for giving me my pride.
Hey, wait a minute. That's not the Brian Lehrer Show theme. That's I Want to Thank You by Otis Redding. But that's a better way to begin our Thanksgiving show, I think, don't you? So happy Thanksgiving, everyone. It is the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. And pinch me, we are here live to keep you company on this Thanksgiving morning as you cook or travel or if you're just taking the holiday off from all that and hanging out alone. Hello. We'll sprinkle in more Thanksgiving music. Along the way, from now until noon, we'll have a couple of guests and take lots of your calls on the meaning of Thanksgiving. Also, who you would like to name, who you would like to thank for something in particular. Like Otis Redding there, thanked someone for being so nice and for giving him pride. Those were the lyrics that we just played. Can you believe he got away with rhyming nice and pride? I guess Otis Redding can pull that off. Most of us absolutely cannot. And later we'll also take calls on your immigrant Thanksgiving meal plates. We had a caller yesterday when we weren't even doing this topic yet who mentioned that his family is from China and they never have turkey. They usually have suckling pig and abalone. So that was yesterday. We'll invite you to call later and tell us how your immigrant family combines traditional dishes from your heritage country with what we tend to consider an American Thanksgiving, or maybe you don't combine them at all, and that's fine too. Thanksgiving is a good day to do a land acknowledgement. So this is the Brian Lehrer Show in Lenape Hoking, what we now call New York, but the homeland of the Lenape people who were displaced from here by European colonialism. We will talk in a few minutes with Lakawi Hene Oaks from the North American Indigenous Center of New York. She will join our first guest, historian Kenneth C. Davis, author of the Don't Know Much About series of books, the original Don't Know Much About History, and many others. He's got a new one that we'll talk about later called Great Short Books, A Year of Reading Briefly. But he's also written extensively about the origins of Thanksgiving and how it's changed over time. So hi, Ken Davis. Always good to have you on. Happy Thanksgiving to you and welcome back to WNYC.
Happy Thanksgiving to you, Brian, as well. And I am always grateful, first of all, for the opportunity to join you. It's always a pleasure. We've been doing this a long time, it seems. I don't even want to think about that. But it is always a thrill and a wonderful opportunity to talk about history and holidays, and certainly today, my other favorite topic, books.
Which we will get to. But let's begin for now, not with the so-called original Thanksgiving story, but with some thoughts from a Thanksgiving essay that you wrote in the New York Times back in 2014. I read that last night, and one thing I didn't know was that the first president of the United States, George Washington, was the first to issue a proclamation of Thanksgiving, as did James Madison a few presidents later. But in both cases, if I understood you correctly, calling for somber days of prayer. Can you give us some of the context for George Washington's proclamation of Thanksgiving and why it was somber?
That's correct. The somber part is simply because to Washington, to the Pilgrims and Puritans of an earlier colonial era, a day of Thanksgiving would have meant something very different from what we are talking about. To them, a day of Thanksgiving meant a day of prayer and fasting, not exactly what most of us have in mind for later in this day. So a very, very different idea. Washington's proclamation was to be a day of gratitude for the Constitution itself. It was right after the ratification of the United States Constitution. James Madison's proclamation was a day of thanksgiving for the end of the War of 1812. And so these were proclamations of thanksgiving, again, calling for prayer and fasting and gratitude to Providence, this somewhat amorphous deity that deists like Washington would often use. So the real connection to what we're celebrating today does not come about until 1863, when Abraham Lincoln issues a proclamation of thanksgiving in the midst of some of the darkest days of the American Civil War. Quite extraordinary that Lincoln thought this was still an occasion for which we should express gratitude at a time when he was mourning the death of his own son about a year earlier. The Gettysburg Battle had been fought a few months earlier, and Lincoln had in fact just delivered the Gettysburg Address on November 19th, 1863. So a dark day to be telling America it should be grateful for all of its gifts.
And even before Lincoln, you remind us in that article that a woman named Sarah Josepha Hale started advocating for a National Day of Thanksgiving around 1837. So what kinds of Thanksgiving days existed by then? Was it still the somber day of fasting? It's so funny to think that Thanksgiving was a day of fasting. Now it's a day of gorging yourself. But what kinds of Thanksgiving days existed by 1837? And what did Sarah Josepha Hale have in mind?
Well, let me briefly explain that she was the editor of a magazine at that time called Godey's Ladies' Book. I suppose you would describe it perhaps today as the Good Housekeeping of its day. Mm. Perhaps she was the Martha Stewart of her day. Mm. She's also notable, we should point out, for having contributed to American folkways as the author of Mary Had a Little Lamb. Oh. I did not know that until I did some research on her a few years ago. But she had been advocating for a National Day of Thanksgiving since 1837. She saw it as a day of commemoration of gratitude to our Heavenly Father, observed in one section or state. And what she was pointing out was that this was a tradition observed in New England primarily, where it was once called Founders Day. This connection of a day of thanksgiving to the arrival of the Pilgrims and later the Puritans. And she thought that this should be a day that the whole country should recognize and sympathize with gratitude and gladness, as she put it. Lincoln's proclamation in 1863, perhaps at the behest of Sarah Josepha Hale, was the beginning of an unbroken string of presidential proclamations placing Thanksgiving Day on a Thursday in November. And that date shifted around a little bit, and we can come back to that in a minute. It's not until 1940 or 41 that Congress actually makes Thanksgiving a national holiday. Long before that, people didn't like the idea of the federal government declaring holidays that were semi-religious in their nature, and they thought that this should be left up to the states. So many states and many governors would declare a day of Thanksgiving, and by the middle of the 19th century, a Thanksgiving meal was much more associated with what we would consider a traditional English, almost Christmas meal. And so that's where the turkey and or the goose comes in. Far, far different, of course, from what the so-called Pilgrims ate in 1621.
Yeah. So how did that real or mythical meal between settlers and indigenous people from 1621 get connected to all that you were describing from the 1700s and the 1800s?
It's a really important question, Brian, because it gets to the question of how we tell our history and how we have told our history in this country for a very long time, a subject that is very much at hand right now. We are fighting over who gets to tell history in this country. That's so it's right. A very important story. And I, like a great many other historians, have been trying to get the accurate story of Thanksgiving and the accurate story of American history right for a very long time. And it is a struggle because we're up against a tremendous amount of mythology, legend making that has been around for truly hundreds of years. Just for the simple facts, the so-called Pilgrims arrive on the Mayflower in 1621. I should say December of 1620. They are coming to America ostensibly to start a new colony. It's a lousy time to go to Massachusetts, December of to start a new colony. But there they drop anchor, the Mayflower. About half of the 102 passengers are what we would call pilgrims. They didn't call themselves that. The other half were people who were coming to establish, get some property in this new world. There was a very small chance for an Englishman to get his own property in England at the time. So this was, for many of these immigrants, a chance for opportunity in the new world, a tradition that continues, obviously, to our own time.
And they, I guess I'm, go ahead, finish that thought. Go ahead. No, you go.
Oh, I was going to say they then drop anchor. They the men come ashore and begin to build a communal house. The women stay on board the Mayflower, which remains there for 3 months. And it is a communal house. So we can actually say also that the Massachusetts, this Massachusetts Plymouth colony begins as a sort of exercise in socialism, dare I even say communism. They were living in a communal house. They were taking care of each other. Something else probably that wouldn't go over too well these days with some more traditionalists. This was, of course, part of the religious warfare that was going on in Europe at the time. These pilgrims, let's call them that for the moment, were actually separatists. They wanted to leave the Church of England, begun by Henry VIII when he broke with the Roman Catholic Church. And they felt that the Church of England was still too what they would have called popish. And by that, they would have meant Catholic. They wanted a purer church, and they wanted to separate from it. This is what distinguishes them from the later Puritans, who were faithful to the Church of England, but they just wanted to purify it, hence the word Puritans. Mm-hmm. So all of this begins a long time ago with a lot of religious infighting.
And funny enough, I think we consider Thanksgiving a very secular holiday today. This is a day when whatever your religion is or other aspects, various other aspects of our background, certainly our political polarization, you know, and the way we divide into political tribes these days, that's supposed to be left at the door at Thanksgiving. So it's really changed in that respect to being about as secular a holiday as maybe we have in this country.
Well, in the earliest days, when it became a sort of Puritan holiday among New Englanders, it was essentially first a church-going day with a meal that followed. And it was celebrating that, eventually celebrating that legendary feast. Let me add one other piece into this story here, and it's an important part of the story I'm sure your next guest will pick up on. These people are struggling to survive. There's no question about it. Within the first few months, many of the Mayflower passengers began to die. Exposure, disease, just the difficulty, malnutrition. One day in March, they actually start burying these people at night because they don't want the local natives, they know they're there and they know they're watching them, to know how many of them are dying. But one day in March, a half-naked native man walks into the village and astonishes these people by speaking to them in English. His name comes down to us as Samoset. A few days later, he returns with another man who speaks even better English. His name comes down to us as Squanto. All children learn that story of how Squanto comes into the village and helps the pilgrims learn how to plant corn with a piece of fish, and this is such a miraculous thing.
Yeah.
But no one explains how Squanto knows English, and that's an important piece of the story. Squanto spoke English because several years before, he had been taken captive by an English sea captain, taken to Spain and sold into slavery, makes his way eventually to London, where someone recognizes that a Native American who speaks English and knows the territory might be very useful in future explorations. So he makes his way back to North America on an English ship, and he is there looking at first for his own family and friends. It is that village, Squanto's village, to which the pilgrims actually settle. The village is deserted except for bleached bones. The entire village had been wiped out in a pandemic. Pandemics and plagues are very important in American history. So where did that pandemic come from? Probably from the English and other European sailors, fishermen, traders who had plied these coasts for a very, very long time. All of that is left out of this history.
One more thing before we open the phones to callers. And if you're just joining us, everybody, we are here live on Thanksgiving, The Brian Lehrer Show, with historian Kenneth C. Davis, our first guest, who will be joined in a couple of minutes by Lakawi Henne-Oakes from the North American Indigenous Center of New York. And we will pick up on some of the things, less about history than about today, actually. But we'll continue to move this conversation forward and include your calls. But one more thing from the narrative that you gave us in your New York Times article a few years ago, and this may sound more like something from today, but you told us there was a Democratic and Republican Thanksgiving, competing Thanksgivings by party during FDR, and even a derisive nickname, which is something we associate maybe with Donald Trump, hello, Ron DeSanctimonious, of Franksgiving from one side instead of Thanksgiving, Franksgiving. Tell us that story.
That's right. Because Thanksgiving had not been established as a national holiday yet, it was simply a day that the president made a proclamation starting from Lincoln's in 1863. In 1939, the retailers came to Roosevelt, Franklin D. Roosevelt, and asked him to move up the traditional Thanksgiving Thursday 1 week. And Roosevelt agreed because they made the case that this would help them. And the country was still coming out of the Depression. It would help them with holiday sales, which have been linked to Thanksgiving for a very long time. That's not a new creation of Black Friday. So Roosevelt does this, agrees with the retailers to do this. The Republicans in Congress scream that he is trampling on a sacred American tradition. And so they decide to keep their Thanksgiving on a more traditional date. So 32 states joined Roosevelt's Democratic Thanksgiving in 1939. 16 others stuck with the traditional date, which became Republican Thanksgiving. And there was also derision of the Democratic date as Franksgiving for Franklin D. Roosevelt. Oh. After some congressional wrangling in December 1941, Roosevelt signed the legislation making Thanksgiving a legal holiday on the fourth Thursday in November, and there it has remained.
Franksgiving.
We can fight about anything in this country.
Anything. Franksgiving for Franklin D. Roosevelt. I guess it didn't mean that they have hot dogs on Thanksgiving instead of turkey on that side of the aisle. All right, listeners, we can take your calls on the meaning of Thanksgiving to you. 212-433-WNYC. You're hearing some of how the holiday was founded on some very somber origins and amplified by Lincoln under very grave circumstances. Is it a time for gratitude for you, even in the face of hardship and loss? Do we have that? Do we have that impulse anymore? If things are going badly, instead of just saying, oh, everything's bad, and it's Thanksgiving, I don't have anything. In the face of hardship and loss, to be grateful. Have we lost that? Is it national for you, the meaning of Thanksgiving? Is it spiritual for you in some of the original religious ways that Ken was describing? Is it intersectional for you in any way beyond gathering with family from both sides of the aisle and having a feast? Your calls on the meaning of Thanksgiving to you, let's say outside of yourself or your most immediate family, 212-433-WNYC. Any Indigenous people listening? We hope you'll call in, as well as anyone else. Indigenous listeners, Do you find anything to celebrate here, given the history of this country? And anyone else, any of your thoughts on the meaning of Thanksgiving outside of your most personal circles? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And in a minute, as Ken Davis stays with us, we'll also be joined by Lakawi Hene Oaks from the Indigenous Center of North America here in New York. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, live on Thanksgiving. Historian Kenneth C. Davis is still with us. And also joining us now is Lakawi Hene Oaks, activist, athlete, artist, and co-founder of the North American Indigenous Center of New York, which describes itself as a Native woman-led and centered nonprofit committed to Indigenous empowerment. Lakawi was last with us on Columbus Day / Indigenous Peoples Day. And Lakawi, thanks for some time today. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hi, Sego. Thank you for having me. It's Yagowine. Yagowine is my name. Thank you for having me. So the topic today is very interesting, and I appreciate you covering this. Today is so-called Thanksgiving, right?
Do you observe Thanksgiving in any way, or if so, how? If not, how? I know that some Indigenous activists and institutions have renamed the day or additionally named it as Thanks-taking or Truths-giving or just call it a day of mourning. So have you adopted or do you relate to any of those in particular?
Yeah, so that's a really like loaded situation and changes over time for many of us. We are, you know, I am Bene Kahaga, I'm Mohawk of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy, also known as Iroquois Confederacy. We're made up of five different nations towards the northeastern region of the United States. And where Thanksgiving occurred was the most eastern shorelines, right? And that was the Wampanoag. So they're a very different nation. They're our neighbors. And there's 574 very distinct nations within the United States that are federally recognized. So we want to keep that in mind. And this is their story. Thanksgiving is their story to tell their history, what they've learned and the things that have been passed down from their ancestors who survived and who fed the pilgrims and who met them and who shared knowledge with them. These are things that slowly made their way to my people, like like what happened during that time and put everybody on guard, all the different nations within the Northeastern territories on guard and prepared for what came not too long after that initial Thanksgiving feast. And it means something very different for Natives as it does for Americans or non-Natives. At one point in my life, my grandparents and a lot of grandparents in Native nations had been living in a very systemically violent circumstances, like on reservations, where they couldn't even leave their reservations without a pass by the colonial settlers, almost like concentration camps. You know, they're very confined to these spaces and also stricken from their families to go to church schools, to go to residential schools and Indian day schools, where they were then indoctrinated. And these holidays that are symbols of maybe family or heritage, American heritage, are in fact to us symbols of the American Holocaust, to the genocide that we experience. You know, and as I got older and as my grandparents, you know, they were slowly more or less like decolonizing themselves. Uh-huh. But really hiding our language and our culture and our ceremonies because they weren't actually legal until 1978. You know, we weren't able to celebrate our ceremonies until after 1978. That was a year before I was born. So my parents lost all of that. So there was obvious cultural genocide, but there was also, you know, what happened 100 years before that, which was extremely violent. And there are still extensions of that through residential schools and Indian day schools where children were getting, sadly, like getting raped and murdered and killed and sick and not like treated for the sicknesses that came across ships, such as the Mayflower, sicknesses that never existed here. So for me, I had a few years of my younger years, maybe till I was 10, where we like just celebrated, blindly celebrated Thanksgiving. But as my mother's generation became more aware and more empowered through things like the American Indian Movement and through things like the occupation of Alcatraz in San Francisco that happened in 1979, which was led by Richard Oakes, a relative of mine, and really igniting the American Indian Movement. So the first 10 years was like a decolonial stretch of time where we were letting go of these erasures of the truth, and really reaching in to understand and learn about our perspective and our history of what had happened. And so now throughout my life, there's been a switch. Like I turned off that blind colonial perspective of history, and am very much more aware now. And to me, a date like Thanksgiving is the opposite of what it might be for an American. It's, you know, it's really like a symbolic marker of genocide and Holocaust for my people, because we were once 100 million and now we're 6.7 million. We're 2.09% of the United States population, you know, and there are still extensions of systemic strategies that are still putting us at risk and that are still effectively decreasing our power and our people and our just our place on this, you know, on this continent. So it means very different things for,
absolutely,
for us.
It means kind of the opposite, as you say, given all the history that you just laid out and reminded people of or told them for the first time in some of those cases if they didn't know it, and of course so much else. So Yagowina, is there a way for non-Indigenous people in this country to keep the Thanksgiving traditions they value, in your opinion, and still respect Indigenous people and their history?
Absolutely. And I see it happening. I think like the first step in everything is acknowledging, right? Is acknowledging and then accepting that truth, learning about that truth, and then figuring out ways to move forward. And it's really like, how can we move forward from this hallmark erasure of what had happened to the original people of this land, right? So what we do have are dates like Indigenous Peoples Day, which is replacing Columbus Day. And to most Native people, Columbus Day and Thanksgiving are not much different in you know, that they mean very different things for us.
Right.
So Thanksgiving is sort of that, but it's also in the midst of November, which has been proclaimed as Native American Heritage Month. And so the entire month, this is a space and time annually where Americans and educational institutions and cultural institutions should really be committing themselves and their resources towards the acknowledgement and towards learning and making space for Native American perspective to happen. And I feel like Thanksgiving, the day itself, I think it is a symbol of American heritage. But it's important to know what the Native American perspective is and what that experience and truth is as well. And the entire month of November is really a time for learning and exposure and creating space for us, because that's the number one thing that has been taken from us. And then also erased throughout society. So hopefully that there will be, you know, some course correction especially in New York City, where, you know, that's a great example in the Northeast, where there's been so much removal of Native Americans from their lands, the Lenape in particular, who have been, you know, violently removed towards Oklahoma and Wisconsin and up north in on the Canadian side of the border. It's really important to learn these histories and learn who and what was sacrificed for Americans' presence currently and presence and privilege on this land.
Yagawine Oaks from the North American Indigenous Center of New York and historian Kenneth C. Davis with us live on Thanksgiving. To what you just said, and I want to get both of you to weigh in on this. These days, more people are saying out loud that the United States was created on land stolen from the indigenous people. We did a land acknowledgement at the beginning of the show today. I said WNYC is in Lenape Hoking on Lenape land. I want to read two more examples and then ask you both to talk about them. I'm going to read briefly from the land acknowledgments from NYU's History Department and the New York City Commission on Human Rights. The Human Rights one says on their website, the commission acknowledges the land politically designated as New York City to be the homeland of the Lenape, Lenape Hoking, who were violently displaced as a result of European settler colonialism over the course of 400 years. The Lenape are a diasporic people that remain closely connected with this land and are its rightful stewards. So that's the one from the New York City Commission on Human Rights. The NYU School of Arts and Sciences website says in part, the Department of History at New York University acknowledges that it is located in ancestral Lenape homelands, and it recognizes the longstanding significance of these lands for Lenape nations past and present. We believe that historical awareness of indigenous exclusion and erasure is critically important and are committed to working to overcome their effects in our own educational institutions. That from NYU's History Department. So Ken, for you as a historian, was there anything like land acknowledgments of any kind? How early in U.S. history? Or was it really all like out of sight, out of mind for most non-Indigenous Americans until really, really recently?
Absolutely, Brian. It was very much out of sight, out of mind, and worse than out of sight, out of mind, caricatured in the, you know, cutouts that we would see in the supermarket windows of the little children with their bows and arrows and feathers in their hair, and the little pilgrim children with their black hats and buckles. This is the mythology that has been so much a part of this. But just to continue on this notion of acknowledgement, very interesting that the Plymouth Plantation Museum, as it once was called, is now the Plymouth Patuxet Museum, acknowledging that this land and this part of this American history is tied in with the entire history of this nation, of this place. So I think that's an important landmark to sort of point out that people are acknowledging this, just as Monticello and now Vernon are now much more openly acknowledging the history of enslaved people in those landmark places. So we have had a real swing in the pendulum towards acknowledging the real history and the beginning of what was clearly a genocide in this country. 40 years after those Wampanoag, led by Massasoit, sit down at the so-called First Thanksgiving, Massasoit's son, who was known as King Philip, took his people to war against the Anglo colonists. It was the bloodiest war of America's colonial history by far. And there are very graphic descriptions, which I included 30 years ago and don't know much about history, of the burning of a village in what is now Rhode Island. So we have slowly come to realize that this is part of the story that the history books left out, unfortunately, right now, we have a pull going back in the opposite direction, where states are saying, we don't want to teach these kind of stories right. that will make our children feel ashamed. That's one of the most dangerous things, I think, that is going on in America right now. It's tied in very closely, of course, to the banning of books. So thank you to the guest for bringing that perspective to this. We do need to celebrate our gratitude, because we have a lot to be thankful for, but we can still do that with an honest eye to looking at what happened in this country over centuries. It is a shameful, dark part of American history that was swept under the carpet for way too long.
So, Yagawini, are the land acknowledgments meaningful to you or other Mohawk or other Indigenous people you know? Or are they received as just a little lip service? Like when these acknowledgments that I just read say things like the Lenape are the rightful stewards of this land, and that comes from the city government of New York. Well, the city government of New York is not about to turn over Manhattan or anything else back to the Lenape. So what does saying that even mean that's not disingenuous?
Yeah, sure. So, I actually often work with that commission, human rights. So land acknowledgements, they're very interesting. In the beginning, they felt meaningful. And while people were, you know, navigating that from different institutions and so forth, trying to figure out what to write within those land acknowledgements, it seemed well-meaning. But then ultimately, after a couple of years passing, as natives, we see it now as just another hallmark symbol of fulfilling whatever diversity and inclusion that cannot be physically filled mm-hmm. by including us, who I know for a fact that we are purposely excluded from a lot of things within American society, especially in all of these city and state and federal departments. We are really very much erased. And in New York City, I've been working in New York City and community and in Native, I guess, politics and advocacy for a very long time. I really feel like the exclusion of all the other Native nations within the Northeast does a service to those that want to keep things simple and just get through it and say, oh, we did the land acknowledgement, we do it every time, but that's not enough. That will never be enough. Not until we are fully acknowledged and included as the nations within that region.
Short of returning land?
Yeah, it's easier for them to deal with natives that are removed from the territory than mm-hmm. it actually is to deal with the natives that are actually present and there in the territory. And if you ever look at a map and you look at the percentage of Native Americans in the United States by state, you will see the majority of the Northeast and lower Southern Eastern states, very low percentages because things hit here first and then they moved west, right? So that erasure, that systemic erasure is still happening within these land acknowledgements. Mm-hmm. For example, the United States Constitution and the founding of that originated from the Haudenosaunee people. Those principles and structures and of democracy originated from the Haudenosaunee people in the Northeast. But in society, there's very little information about Northeastern or Eastern Native nations. And as far as like the land acknowledgements, there's a lot of work to do. That's like the cover to a book. That's the cover page to a book. You know, so what are we going to do from there? How are you actually going to give back and repair? And how are we going to move forward and develop a better relationship together other than, you know, just throwing a stamp on things and thinking that's enough, because it is not enough. And what will be enough at the end of the day is creating equitable spaces and inclusion within not only these systems, but within the reform of systems that violently, cause harm to not only indigenous people, but also our brothers and sisters of like the southern, from the southern border, that should also have a place in a welcoming process of coming to the United States, but are separated by these borders. There's just so much work to do. And places like the Human Rights Commission and NYU, they know, and they know what that work is, but it's like, are we just going to talk about it, or are we actually going to contribute and mm-hmm. mobilize our resources to actually do something and be effective and impactful and help the marginalized people and really create a space of inclusion when it comes to rewriting and rewriting history and reforming how we move forward. So it's a very empty thing for me now. It was interesting in the beginning, a few years ago, the land acknowledgements, but now it's a very empty thing because it's stopping there. And when the inclusion that they think we need is more performative, you know, they might bring in natives to like bead or show art or dance, but that's great. And that's great for kids as well. But I think it's important that like there's a lot of truth that needs to be told in space that needs to be created for us. And that's like a sentiment of land back, which is another phrase that you might hear a lot in Native cultures. And I think that kids, that the idea of we don't want the kids to feel ashamed, I think it's the opposite. Realistically, it's the opposite. When we teach them how bad things were and where we're at now and how they can move forward, those kids will be proud, you know, and maybe contributors to that reform as well. So I just really think that things need to shift, and I don't think that kids, I think kids will see things differently. And I know the generation younger than myself, I'm in my 40s, but the generation beneath me is like the younger generation. They're very active. They're activated. And that's something to be proud of. And they're determined to create change. And the ones underneath them, those are their heroes. So we need to support that movement and that shift.
And turning on its head, what people say is going to create shame and what could be looked at as something that would create pride, that's really, really interesting. Jackie in Rockland County, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jackie.
Oh, hi there. Can you hear me okay?
Uh-huh.
Okay. Thanks for the show. I would just like to say, I was asked, you know, what is Thanksgiving to me? And I just would like to say, first of all, I live on Ramapo, Lenape, Munsee lands here in Rockland County, very close to the beautiful Great White Hudson River, where I grew up. And so Thanksgiving in our house was always this very open affair with friends and family and strangers. And then in 1970, when I was 12 years old, a neighbor of ours named Lane Slate wrote and directed a documentary called Trail of Tears. And I was 12 years old, and it was probably as much of a rude awakening as this woman has been saying on your show is the Holocaust, is the Holocaust in Europe. It was the Holocaust here, and my 12-year-old mind changed. We had not learned about these things in school. And so Thanksgiving then became something that was, yes, a celebration of friends and family, but also kind of a day of mourning. And we would always take a walk up to Eagle Rock, which was way on the top of the Hudson River and the cliff, kind of a dividing point between New Jersey and New York. And we'd walk up the Indian Steps. There were about 100 of them, to the top of Eagle Rock. And it's changed my perspective. I'm as much as I can be friends with our Ramapo Lenape friends in Mahwah and Rockland County and Chief Perry. And we've just always had this day as a very mixed day in our family, because of these feelings of such sadness, from what we learned, you know, when I was just 12 years mm-hmm. old.
Jack, do you see, Jackie, anybody, any of your neighbors or more extended family picking up that awareness, because what the story that you're telling about yourself kind of connects to what our guest was saying is happening for some people as a kind of evolution of awareness in, you know, more recent generations. Both our guests said that. Do you see it happening around you?
I do. I definitely do. Here in Rockland County, we have one of our social justice groups called the Rockland Coalition to End the New Jim Crow has very close ties to our indigenous friends, the Ramapo Lenape, and we try to bring awareness. We also fight for the rights of the river to be free, and I know that's something that our Native American tribes actually throughout the world are fighting for, not just Native Americans. So there is a big awareness that's happening here in Rockland County, although there is still a lot of negativity. I went to a school board meeting in Clarkstown, which was about CRT, and you know, people were talking about they were talking about dirty Indians, and I just was absolutely stunned that this kind of thinking still exists here. But we're trying to crack it.
And at a school board meeting, no less, right? Which is where so much of this breaks out these days all around the country. Jackie, thank you for sharing your story. Elliot in Manhattan has a history question for Ken. Elliot, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi. Happy Thanksgiving, Brian. Happy Thanksgiving, Ken. Yes. Ken, I'm wondering if you could tell us a little more about the autumn of 1863, which is when President Lincoln proclaimed the Thanksgiving. That Thanksgiving holiday that he proclaimed was very shortly after his address in Gettysburg, which he had been working on for a long time. And so I was curious to know if there's any sort of tie-in as far as he's concerned between those events. Also, I'm curious about Evacuation Day, which previously was the late November
Thank
holiday.
You. Ken, give us about a minute on that, and then we need to take a break.
I think I mentioned Lincoln issuing this proclamation in what would have been a very somber time for him, certainly. And in fact, he had delivered the Gettysburg Address on November 19th, 1863. So this Thanksgiving proclamation comes out a few weeks later. Of course, the Gettysburg Address was the commemoration of the cemetery at Gettysburg, where Union soldiers were being interred in this, what the creation of the first national cemetery. So he, and as I mentioned, he was still wearing a mourning armband for his own son. And of course, reading the casualty reports every day. So it was a bleak, bleak time in American history. Gettysburg had been fought. Remember, right out a few days after, here in New York, after Gettysburg, we had the draft riots, where Black Americans were absolutely killed by largely Irish rioters who did not want to be drafted for a war that was now clearly being fought about slavery, since the announcement of another proclamation, the Emancipation Proclamation. So it was a very, very perilous time in the war. Lincoln knew he was going to be up for a re-election in 1864. The election would be coming up. He was quite certain he wouldn't be re-elected as the year began. So it is remarkable that in this, now maybe you could say, well, he's just dashing off a kind of pro forma thing, but it wasn't. And I think he really believed that this idea called out to those kind of words of mystic chords of memory that he talked about in his inaugural. So I think it's a really powerful moment in American history. I just want to add one other historical note, Brian. I think it's important when we talk about America's birth certificate, the Declaration of Independence, that among the words we don't usually read are these by Thomas Jefferson. He has excited domestic insurrections among us, referring to King George, of course, and has endeavored to bring on the inhabitants of our frontiers, the merciless Indian savages, whose known rule of warfare is an undistinguished destruction of all ages, sexes, and conditions. That was Jefferson's view of the Native American people, and he contributed to the genocide.
Good for everybody to know when we try to take 360-degree understandings of the founders of this country into account. So, Ken, thank you for that. And Yagawine Oaks, co-founder of the North American Indigenous Center, thank you very much for joining us again today. Thanks for coming back on the show. Talk to you again, I hope.
Yawagoa, thank you for having me.
And Ken Davis is going to stay with us for something completely different coming up in a minute. Brian Lehrer with you live here on Thanksgiving. Stay with us right until noon.